Woo, here's a hot take on this week's episode.
When my kids were adolescents, I used to say there were three things that I could do to save my mental health as a father. One was never speak unless spoken to. Mm-hmm. If you must speak, never offer an opinion. And thirdly, never expect a truthful response to a question.
Never expect your kids to tell you the truth.
Yeah, when they're teenagers. Those are a little cynical, but
that is funny.
I learned the hard way. And believe me, talking to other parents at the same time, like, yeah. Set the pace, watch me steal the show. Higher ground, yeah, I'm rising fast. This is my moment, it's built to last. Keep the focus, keep the drive.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant podcast. We're taking you from burned out to balanced, beautiful, and abundant through aligning your life in the seven pillars of abundance: spiritual, physical, emotional, romantic, mental, social, and financial. Today, we have one of the top experts in the world in the mental wellness profession. Welcome to the show, Dr. Paul Keck.
Hi, Rebecca. Thank you for your kindness in inviting me to be on. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm so happy that you're on the show. And we have a family history because you are a psychiatrist and used to work with my dad. May he rest in peace. He was a psychiatrist at the University of Cincinnati Medical School, Medical Hospital. And we connected on Facebook. And as soon as I saw your profession, I had to ask if you knew my dad. And of course you did. And I feel like he might be behind this connection because I feel like in this chapter of my life, he's pulling a lot of the strings, as crazy as that may seem.
Well, that's fun.
Well, it's great to see you here. And I'm so excited to dive into all the stuff that you do. But first, let me tell my audience about your illustrious background. So Dr. Paul Keck is a true pioneer in the world of mental health. He is the founding president and CEO of the Linder Center of Hope in Mason, Ohio. He is an emeritus professor of psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. And he is internationally known for his groundbreaking work in the areas of mood disorders, including depression and bipolar disorders. So, Paul, what got you interested in psychiatry out of all the different specialties you could have as a physician?
Well, it was an epiphany, actually. I experienced with it, unfortunately, in family and friends. And I went to Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. And usually you plan your last clinical rotation in third year as the area you least want to go into. And my last rotation was psychiatry, and it was at the Bronx VA, which was a salon of teaching and research. Some of the brightest people I've ever known were working there. But that wasn't really the inspiration. The inspiration was working with a young man who was almost exactly my age. He was the first patient I was assigned to understand. And he had one of the worst cases of schizophrenia I've ever seen. He could barely speak. His words were unintelligible. His thoughts were all over the place. And I called his mother to try to get more history. And when I was talking to her, I said in my hubris as a medical student, because there was still an idea, horrible as it was, that there was such a thing as a schizophrenogenic mother, which I thought was nonsense and is. But I said to her, you know, you didn't cause this. And she burst into tears. She said, nobody's ever told me that. But that experience gave me a perspective. I had my whole life ahead of me, a career in something, and he had nothing to look forward to. The medicines that we had then were ineffective in controlling his psychosis. And I thought, you know, we know a lot about almost every other organ system in the body and how it works, but we know nothing, really. This is 40 years ago, about the brain. And I thought if I could make a tiny little contribution, understanding the underlying causes, psychological, biological, of mental illness, that would be a life worth living. So at the last minute, I decided to go into psychiatry. It was one of those there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Yeah.
And it was an incredibly unpopular decision. In fact, the dean of the medical school called me into his office when I decided to go into psychiatry. I had seen the dean once, and that was in the white coat ceremony the first week of medical school. So I thought, proverbial called into the principal's office. What did I do wrong? Does he know about my roommate's massive stash of marijuana? So he tried to dissuade me from going into psychiatry. He said, you're throwing your career away. You have so much to offer in other areas. And, you know, I was full of myself, and I was polite to him. And I said, well, you know, thank you for talking to me. I'll think it over. As soon as I walked out the door, my decision was even more firm. But that was the stigma the field had then.
What was the stigma about it? Did people think it was like woo-woo and not founded in science? Like,
yes. Esoteric?
Okay.
Both. Yeah. Namby-pamby field, wasting your time as a physician. He was a world-famous liver specialist, and he just didn't understand the field and how it was beginning to evolve.
And had you ever been in therapy or had any awareness of psychiatry as a profession before you did your residency in it?
No, none.
And then as a psychiatrist, you have to go through therapy, right?
Well, not really.
Psychoanalysis.
Yeah, I was a resident at the gradual demise of psychoanalytic dominance of psychiatry and at the rise of neurobiology and psychopharmacology.
Okay.
And when I was in training, I went to McLean Hospital right outside of Boston, and we were, as residents, we were pitted between these two schools of thought. And I was the only resident in my class who did not go on to psychoanalytic training. And people thought it was heresy.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to do research, and I wanted to spend my time doing research. And so it just didn't make sense. Moreover, I had a supervisor who once told me, we had supervision, and that was it wasn't really psychotherapy. It was teaching you how to be a psychotherapist. And he said to me, young Dr. Keck, don't you realize psychotherapy is 80% common sense and 20% telling someone they're doing something foolish, but in a kind way? That was also an epiphany. And that's how I practiced from then on. Now, that presumes that your mental health provider has common sense.
Yes.
And I think ultimately what I found in 40 years in the field was what really matters is the human connection. I never treated patients like patients. I treated them like human beings. And when I stopped seeing people in an ongoing way when I left Cincinnati to come to Arizona, I got a number of really lovely notes from people I've been working with, some for many years. And they all said, you treated me like a human being, and I felt like you cared about me. And I think that was the biggest difference.
I think that is so beautiful, because some doctors have God complex and they talk down to people, and for people to feel the human connection is everything. I mean, I've been in therapy sessions where my therapist has cried. They've cried the tears that I couldn't cry because I repress a lot of my negative emotions. And that meant everything to me, that I felt like so understood and seen. And I think in whatever profession you do, there's a lot of entrepreneurs listening to this show today, having the human connection. You know, we're in a society, I think, that is switching from transactional to more relational. And it's such a beautiful shift, but not everybody has made it. I've been slow to make it. I'm starting to catch up and get better at human connection.
Well, I hope that's true. And when I became CEO at Lender Center of Hope, I had a CEO coach for 2 years before the center opened when we were building it.
You hired a coach?
Yeah.
Nice.
I was strongly encouraged to by a buddy of mine, and it was great advice. And this woman, her name's Deb Ewer, I met with her the very first day, and I was so anxious. I didn't know what a spreadsheet was. I didn't know what a cash flow statement was. And after about 20 minutes, she said, you know what? Business is about three things. Relationships, relationships, relationships.
Oh.
And she said, and you are good at relationships. You can hire all the other people you need to do all those other things. And it calmed me down. That's and it really great. Alleviated my anxiety.
That now, is.
I did have to learn what those other things were.
Yeah. But you could hire people. You know, in the book Think and Grow Rich, Henry Ford, who created Ford Motors, he had like a grade school education. They're like, how do you do the books on a billion-dollar company? He said, it's easy. I push a button and an accountant walks in. If you have the relationships down, you can delegate everything else and stay in your zone of genius, which is obviously what you did. So mental health is on people's minds. I think ever since COVID, we've been in a mental health crisis with more anxiety, depression, suicide. What do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions people have about mental health today?
Mental health or mental illness?
Both.
Well, starting with mental health.
Yeah.
So many unhealthy things that we all can do. I think one of the most important things is rolling. The here and now. The massive distraction, many upsetting things on social media.
Yeah.
So I think that's a problem. And I think contributes to isolation. We are wired, most of us, to have human connection. And social media and screen time and all of that, even Zoom puts a distance between yourself and other people. And that's extraordinarily unhealthy. I think that's the biggest challenge we face. The other issues are, I think, less family time. Mm-hmm. Even when I was full-time psychiatrist for many, many years, I always got out in time to coach my kids' sports teams. That was a priority for me. And I think the more time you can spend with your family and, there's the whole quality time thing, but just time, just being there.
Yeah.
Essential and listening. When my kids were adolescents, I used to say there were three things that I could do to save my mental health as a father. One was never speak unless spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
If you must speak, never offer an opinion. And thirdly, never expect a truthful response to a question.
Never expect your kids to tell you the truth.
Yeah, when they're teenagers. those are a little cynical, but I learned the hard way. And believe me, talking to other parents at the same time, like, yeah. Separation for adolescents, I always thought was kind of a passive thing on the part of the parents. They, the struggle was they're finding their way. What I didn't realize is sometimes teenagers can be so hateful that you want them to go. That's part of separation too.
Is it like that in all cultures or just America? I feel like Western cultures or American teens are way harder on their parents than in other cultures.
Yeah, maybe it's because we permit it more. Yeah. I don't know about, I mean, honest answer is I don't know about other cultures. I really don't.
How old are your kids now?
38 and almost 40.
And do you still think they're not telling the truth whenever they open their mouth?
No.
Well, some good.
Since around the early 20s.
Okay. Okay. And what do? Are they in mental health or what do they do?
My oldest son is a professional poker player.
Whoa, that's very psychological.
Yes.
That's like psychological warfare.
It's really fun. My younger son is an entrepreneur.
Okay. What were some of his recent businesses that he tried?
He created a product. It's a good idea. It's a product called Mountain Mites. It was a product designed to mimic the effects of high altitude. It's a pill for low altitude athletes. So in other words, it changes the pulmonary physiology quickly.
Yeah.
There's a great idea.
That is.
Didn't go very far.
That's a great idea because I had a really good friend. His lifelong dream was to hike Machu Picchu, and he was in great shape at a lower elevation, and he got up there and his nose wouldn't stop bleeding and he could not fulfill, went all the way to Peru and could not fulfill his lifelong dream because his body couldn't acclimate to the elevation. So I think, you know, your son might want to pick that up. Maybe someone who's listening might want to invest in him. I don't know. But we're going to cut to a quick commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the dichotomy between high-achieving people appearing successful but struggling internally. We'll be right back. Do you remember slumber parties as a kid? Wearing pajamas, laughing until midnight, eating delicious food, and feeling completely free. Before the bills, the responsibilities, and the pressure of adult life. What if you could experience that magic again as an adult? On February 27th and 28th, I'm hosting the second Soulful Slumber Party in Cincinnati, Ohio. The first one sold out, and this experience is truly unforgettable. You'll receive luxury silk pajamas, a night at a beautiful hotel, a sacred cacao ceremony, a gentle yoga session, a professional photo shoot, my signature Seven Pillars of Abundance workshop, and an elegant dinner party with an incredible group of like-minded women. This is your chance to reconnect with your joy, your vision, and yourself. If you feel called, apply through the link in the show notes. I'll see you at the slumber party. Hey there, it's Rebecca, your magnetic abundance mentor. Let me ask you something. Are you feeling stuck, burned out, or like life just isn't as juicy as you know it can be? If you're nodding right along, it's time for a breakthrough. My coaching program is designed to help you align your life in all seven pillars of abundance: spiritual, physical, emotional, romantic, mental, social, and financial, so you can finally live that big, bold, sexy, and adventurous life you deserve. And here's the best part. I'm inviting you to schedule a breakthrough call with me. No pressure, no sales gimmicks, just a genuine chance to experience my coaching firsthand and get crystal clear on what is next for you. Because your best life is not a someday thing, it's a right now thing. So click the link in the show notes to book your breakthrough call and let's start making magic together. Your next level is calling you. This podcast review is from Bring It On, and she says that the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant show is amazing and inspiring. She goes on to say, I believe this show is a place where women can come and really learn and grow. Rebecca creates a strong and safe space for women to share and be vulnerable. I highly recommend this podcast. Thank you so much. And it is absolutely a safe place for all women to come and learn. Thanks for being a great listener. Welcome back to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant podcast. I am here with renowned psychiatrist, Dr. Paul Keck. And Paul, why is there such a dichotomy between high achieving people? I mean, you see it with athletes or movie stars or wealthy people that look like they have everything anyone could ever want and more on the outside, but inside they're struggling.
That's a complicated question, Rebecca. First of all, there are a lot of low achieving people who are also suffering. Well, I think one of the key missions in life is to do something meaningful and have a purpose. I've seen so many people, especially struggling with depression, who have just lost their way. Or they have built their self-identity around their achievements, whether it's in business, athletics, what have you. But along the way, they've sacrificed what we've been talking about earlier, relationships and connection. They become one-dimensional, obsessive people. And that's extraordinarily unhealthy. I worked with a number of people who, for the first time in their lives, after they retired, got profoundly depressed because their lives have been built around their businesses. And they've been successful and all of that. But now suddenly, what am I going to do with my life? What's my identity? I was a power broker and now I'm not. And one of the big challenges working with those folks was not just getting them on the right antidepressant or the right psychotherapy, was you got to go find something to do. And I can't tell you what to do because it's got to come from within, but you got to go find something to do. And when people did, often volunteering or being a mentor, they were a lot better. So I think, and you know, we talk a lot about work-life balance now, and sometimes, especially in the youngest generation, they're almost obsessed with it, to a fault.
And how are they obsessed with it?
Well, again, bad generalization. But in the youngest generation now, I see people who don't want to work many hours. Don't want to put in the hard work. And I was raised that the two most important things to succeed in life were education and hard work. Now, like everything, moderation is important. It's important to work hard, but it's also important to have some work-life balance. The tricky thing is defining that balance. I think individuals have to do it for themselves. They have to find a workplace that allows them to excel on the work part, but also have some time for family, leisure, exercise, things like that.
I think it's the pendulum swinging the other way because baby boomers and Gen X are really hardworking. Millennials can be either way, either hardworking or not. And then Gen Z is like, I'm not going to work hard. And I think it's also because their parents were helicopter parents. And if they forgot something like, oh my God, I forgot to take the crust off your peanut butter sandwich, I'm going to come to school in the middle of math and hand you it. And they just overparented and they didn't teach the kids how to have grit and like how to like really roll up their sleeves and realize that life requires some grit and persistence and everything's not always going to be handed to you. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's self-reliance. Kids have to fail. I have to fail.
Yes.
And playing time. It's a lesson. And you have to get out and learn that lesson. You know, I think that's a huge issue. Responsibility, reliance, self-reliance. There's a quote somewhere that says, "No one's coming to save you." No one should be.
No one should be. That's a fantasy. And a lot of women listen to their show. They have a fantasy that the knight in shining armor is coming to save her and pay all your bills and all that. But you know what? It's not. And you're an employee, really?
Yes.
You become. Yes. So I really like that, Paul. No one is coming to save you. And, you know, somebody told me, if you marry for money, you earn every dime. And I think that is true too. So we all have people in our life that we might not know are struggling with mental illness, but we care. What are some early signs, some warning signs that someone we know might be struggling with a mood disorder?
Followed from a family wanting to hear even a person themselves wanting to know, do I have a problem and can I get help? Or should my loved one? And if somebody has passed the threshold to make that call, this is really a problem.
Yeah.
The first warning signs are usually drop in performance, whether it's the personal, professional and vocational, social withdrawal, people dropping normal hobbies, things that they find interesting and pleasurable. Those are usually the warning signs. Sleep disturbance is also a big warning sign. Either trouble falling asleep and staying asleep, or sleeping too much. That's one of the so-called biological symptoms of depression. And then if depression starts to evolve untreated, you start to see appetite changes, either not eating or eating too much, loss of energy, sometimes agitation and severe anxiety. And then, of course, worst of all is suicidal thoughts. So those are the warning signs, and they kind of evolve and unfortunately build on each other. So the goal with depression is like any other medical illness. The earlier you intervene, the better the outcome. Now, it's scary for people to go see a psychiatrist or other mental health provider. I mean, I'm a doctor and I hate going to my doctor. I hate it because it's anxiety provoking. I don't know what they're going to find. What are the blood tests show? And it, you know, maybe something that I didn't notice. You know,
yeah.
All kinds of things. I think there's an even bigger public stigma about going to see a mental health professional. I mean, there are so many myths. Oh, they're mind readers or they're lie detectors. I mean, I'm not a lie detector. I've had so many patients lie to me only to find out later, you were lying to me. Why did you do that? I can't be any help to you if you're lying to me. So I think it's even more intimidating. On the other hand, it's not really any different than going to see any other healthcare provider. The key thing is time. Mm-hmm. People should seek out, if they are concerned, a healthcare provider that will meet with them at least, or mental healthcare provider, at least an hour. Mm-hmm. I met with people an hour and a half because it takes time, A, to build rapport and trust, and B, people are complicated. So for somebody to have time to tell their whole story, they need time. Time and knowledge are the things that we in the mental health field have to offer.
Can you think of a particular case where somebody just was not opening up, and because of the time that you spent with them and the active listening, they eventually opened up and they had like a breakthrough?
I can think of a person I treated with her for about 7 or 8 years. She was struggling with depression, had done better, not well, but it was better. And then she came in a crisis, told me, I need to see you tomorrow. Okay, come on in. And what had happened was she had been having an affair for a year and a half, never told me. And she was caught.
Oh boy.
So you can imagine. But so that wasn't really a breakthrough. It was a crisis.
Yeah.
And led to some breakthroughs.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of people, though, who just with time, not necessarily that first initial consultation, but with ongoing care, as they got to trust me more, they would start to share more and more and more that they hadn't initially. And that's just human nature.
Yeah. Wow, so she's lucky she had a psychiatrist on speed dial. Because when she was caught having an affair, she knew exactly who to call.
What annoyed me was she never told me.
So yeah.
I could have maybe helped, along the way.
Well, let's talk about affairs. I mean, what do you think affairs are really a sign of? Is it like a cry for help? Is it, I know it can be many things, but I'm sure you've treated a lot of patients that had affairs or were thinking about affairs. What do you think, what is your opinion on affairs and marriage, and can they save a marriage? Will they always kill a marriage? Like, I'd love to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Question is an hobby. Some people, just wired to have affairs. So
philanderers. They're serial philanderers.
Yes, thank you. Some people.
Yeah.
Most people are not, and affairs are often disastrous, often leading to the end of a relationship, but don't necessarily have to. Mm-hmm. And in the instances in which, I'm not a couples therapist, by the way, but
yeah,
I worked with couples just to get them the right help, and in instances where they have not destroyed a marriage, and in fact, with work, have improved a marriage or a relationship, it's been critical that each partner is forthright in what was going on, and in the offender's case, if you will, contrite, but also to explain why.
Mm-hmm.
And then for both parties to try to work on, okay, this was what was going south. What can we do to save this marriage? Sometimes it's just the final bullet, like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have the wherewithal to say I'm done. I wanted to get caught. So now we're done.
Yeah.
So all kinds of complicated issues. But like I said, I don't judge. It's a symptom of a bad relationship or a dying relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. That totally makes sense. We are going to cut to a quick commercial break. And when we come back, we are going to talk about what overwhelm and stress actually does to the brain. Thank you for watching and listening to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show. And we'll be right back.
Okay. Can I be real for a second? You're out there crushing it in some areas of your life, but in others, it's like a hot mess express. Sound familiar? Here's the thing. You're not just meant to survive, you're meant to thrive. And that's exactly what I help my clients do in my coaching program. Together, we'll tackle all 7 pillars of abundance, because who wants killer abs but a dumpster fire of a bank account? Or a thriving career but zero in the romance department? Yeah, no thanks. I'm inviting you to schedule a breakthrough call with me. No pressure, no awkward sales pitch, just you, me, and a chance to figure out why you're stuck and how to get unstuck. So stop doom scrolling and start doing something about it. Click the link in the show notes and let's start giving you your best, most bougie life. You in? I want to share something personal that has truly changed how I feel in my body. Like so many women, I was eating healthy, working out, and doing all the right things, but still my metabolism felt slower. I was holding on to belly fat, craving sweets, and my energy wasn't consistent. That's when I started using the EverBalance and GBX Slim to Fit Duo. What I noticed from these two supplements was incredible. My belly fat started to release, my cravings for sugar went way down, and I had a steady, consistent energy flow throughout the day. I didn't feel like I was fighting my body anymore. It finally felt like my body was supporting me. This duo works at the hormonal and metabolic level, which is especially important for women in midlife. I feel more confident, energized, and more like myself again. If you're ready to support your metabolism and step into your most vibrant, magnetic self, go to the link in the show notes to grab your discount.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. Thank you for listening to our show. We're taking you from burned out to balanced, beautiful, and abundant with Dr. Paul Keck, psychiatrist. So you study the brain. What is happening on a physiological level with overwhelm and stress?
So one definition of stress is a potentially very adverse outcome over which you have no control. And by the way, Stoics, I think, are very important in mental health because it's really important to make a distinction between what you can control, because a lot of people think they can control things they can't.
Right.
And that distinction between, okay, I can't control this, let it go, versus, okay, I can control this, I got to do something. Our brains are wired for stress responses. It's probably evolutionarily profoundly important. The biggest threats to human beings are other human beings, tribes versus tribes, you know, and as well as for 99% of human existence, wild animals and things like that. And so those kinds of fight or flight responses are triggered by cortex, our perceptions, the cortex, frontal cortex, right above your eyes. Mm-hmm. That's our decision-making, perception, synthesizing part of the brain. But that's connected to something called the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus then, if there's a stress, sends another hormone called ACTH to our adrenal glands. Our adrenal glands are not in our brain. They're right above the kidneys. The adrenal glands then secrete something called cortisol. Yeah. Some people have had cortisone shots or prednisone, all very similar hormones. A spike in cortisol because of an acute stress is healthy. A chronic exposure to cortisol in the brain because of chronic stress is extremely unhealthy because cortisol changes the brain's biochemistry in a negative way. You know, we've all heard about serotonin from serotonin reuptake inhibitors and other neurotransmitters. Cortisol really wreaks havoc with those pathways in the brain. And so that's where you get anxiety and that's where you get depression. There's also a structure in the brain called the amygdala. The amygdala is like the brain's panic button. Mm-hmm. And once that gets primed, turned on, it's hard to turn off. Mm-hmm. Cortisol turns on the amygdala too. So that's why, anxiety is the response to stress. And anxiety can be treated with medications. There are many very safe and effective medications, and with psychotherapy, ideally with both. So anxiety and depression, in my, both looking at the scientific evidence and in my experience, the goal is always to get people well.
Yes.
Not just a little better, but well. And I told everybody who ever walked in my office that the goal is to get you well. Now, the limitation of that is evidence-based psychotherapy for anxiety and depression take time. So it's not going to happen tomorrow. And medications usually take time too. And right now, we don't yet have the ability. There's a, you know, huge evidence base for specific medicines, but we can't tell. You should be on drug A versus Z. So I always said it's educated trial and error. Mm-hmm. We're going to start with this medicine, but if it doesn't work or if you have side effects, we'll make course changes, but we'll find something. And we almost always did. But I also always begged patients that I worked with to work with me to, you know, I'd lay out a plan. I'd say, are you comfortable with this plan? And if you're not, tell me now, because when you walk out that door, I don't know what you're doing. But if you have a problem, call me. And otherwise, stick with the plan and we'll get you better. And I think that's a truthful statement. But it takes some time, some trial and error.
Let's go back to the cortisol. You mentioned a little bit is good. And I know it's very trendy in the health and wellness biohacking movement to stress your body through a cold plunge or, you know, hot cold therapy, doing really hard sports, just different things that kind of shock the body, you know? So is that what you're saying? Is that why they're saying it's beneficial to the body? The cortisol in a small dose is beneficial, but if it keeps going, if you're always stressed, it's not good. Like, since you're a scientist and a researcher, how do you explain why they say just little bursts of cortisol and challenging the body are actually good and build resilience?
Yes, again, everything is dose. So we all produce cortisol. Our cortisol levels peak at around 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. And then they gradually decline with the rest of the day. And everything's about level. So normal cortisol in the morning is about 9 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
People with depression have cortisol levels 50, 100.
Wow.
We don't want that kind of cortisol bath. For other things that stress the body, cortisol levels will go up a little, but not a lot.
Yeah.
The other thing that happens is you get a massive discharge of your sympathetic nervous system. That's the nervous system that's controlled by epinephrine and norepinephrine. Yeah. And that does a lot of good things. Metabolically, it diminishes appetite. It's good for heart rate variability, which is a healthy thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, in general, it increases muscle regeneration. So exercise, again, in moderation, is a good thing. And I'm sure it's affecting little blips in cortisol and little blips in the sympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, exactly. But if we stay in the sympathetic nervous system and not in the parasympathetic is rest and digest. The sympathetic is fight flight. So the goal is not to be in fight flight all the time, but in spurts, it's okay. But I feel like in current society, with all the pings and dings and news, and a lot of people do stay in their sympathetic nervous system a lot. Do you recommend any good habits or practices for people to decompress and get into their parasympathetic nervous system? Like, what has worked for you personally, your wife, or your patients?
Well, one thing to get back to exercises, what usually happens is, awaken the sympathetic nervous system, but then it usually crashes.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing. Meditation. It's a great way to get the parasympathetic nervous system back online. Anything that you can do that keeps you in the moment, I'll give you some sort of standard examples, gardening, cooking, things that you have to pay attention to.
Yes.
Hiking. When you hike, you can't think about anything other than what's in front of you and nature around you. So those are all good parasympathetic nervous system activators.
And how does someone know when they're out of their parasympathetic into their sympathetic nervous system?
But it's almost not worth obsessing about, quite frankly. This probably just makes me more anxious. No, I think, I'm not wearing right now, and people have Apple watches and things like that. Resting heart rate is a good way to assess that. Really, probably the easiest, simple way. If it's high, sympathetic. If it's normal or low normal, parasympathetic.
I have a Whoop watch, and the second I wake up, want to check my sleep score. And everybody says the worst thing you can do when you wake up is look at your cell phone. And I'm like, well, I want to know my sleep score. How long after you wake up do you check your Whoop watch?
Honestly, I forget. Some mornings, probably an hour. So that's not intentional. I just forget.
Well, I am a recovering overachiever, so I literally open my eyes and check my Whoop sleep score.
I honestly my cell phone as I'm having breakfast to see what's new in the news.
Yeah, yeah, we're all addicted to our phones, even psychiatrists. So what advancements in psychiatry or neurosciences are you most excited about right now?
Oncology is exploding.
Yeah.
Psychotherapy is so advanced. Right now, the area is the glutamate system. Mm-hmm. So glutamate is a neurotransmitter of chemical in the brain. And in contrast, serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, which are the neurochemicals that most of the old antidepressants affected, the glutamate system, they're 1% of the brain. Glutamate is 40% of the brain. And it's involved in mood, cognition, and memory. And there are some new medicines that have been out a year or two or three that seem to work better and faster than the older drugs. And I've seen some true miracles with some of those medicines. So that's very exciting.
And what's the new medicine called?
I don't want to say. I don't want to.
Okay. And by the way, let's do my medical disclaimer. Even though Dr. Paul Keck is an MD, he is not offering anybody listening to the show any medical treatment, advice, recommendations, anything. This is purely for education and entertainment. Don't take anything that we say on the show as medical treatment or advice. Talk to your own physician. Boom. Medical disclaimer done. You don't have to say the names, but they're treating a different part of the brain. And this is really exciting for you. That's
great. Part of the brain is something plasticity and synaptogenesis.
Yeah.
We know now, in the last 30, 40 years, that the better connected the cells are, the better your brain functions. Mm-hmm. So these medicines actually stimulate. So that's one area. The other area on the medication end is psychedelic research. And I think there's an enormous promise there.
Yeah.
For depression, for PTSD, probably for other area, OCD. The clinical trials are nearing potential application to the FDA. Psychedelics have such a negative connotation about them, but everything is about dose and safety. And from the research I've seen so far, they really seem to work. And again, at the right dose, they're not for everybody.
Right.
For people with a history of psychosis, bad idea. But I think they're very promising and probably most effective when given in conjunction with psychotherapy.
Yeah.
Because it seemed to open the mind to all kinds of good things, but you have to process it.
Yeah, you have to find someone to process it with. And I mean, I read an article, I think it was in the New York Times, like Upper East Side psychiatrists are using psychedelics and they're getting great results with their patients. And I think it's just a matter of time before they are legal for psychiatry and psychotherapy, because I've just been reading so many great things about MDMA for talking therapy, opening people up, and psychedelics.
MDMA is also the same as psychedelic. It's different.
Yeah.
We'll see. For planets, helpful.
You don't seem like you're leaving the planet anytime soon. You look very healthy. So I hear that you and your wife have a podcast that you're launching. Tell us about your wife and your marriage and why we all want to listen to the podcast, what it's called and where we can find it.
System with symptoms of the sick, homeless, people with very severe mental illness. In contrast, I worked in a nonprofit but private mental health system, except when I worked at University Hospital. And our experiences overlap nicely, complement each other, I think. But we, you know, over our careers, we've treated thousands and thousands of people individually, one-on-one. And now, as she retired and I'm semi-retired, we thought, gee, and actually it's her idea. We thought, gee, if we could educate the general public about everything we learned, maybe we will help far more people than we did just one-on-one. At least help them go find the right help themselves and understand what's going on. So it's a podcast that we're just starting. It has not been launched. We're right now recording the episodes. It's called Docs Tracy and Paul Discuss It All.
Very cool. Whose idea was the name? Her idea too?
Yes.
Okay.
Around, but I'll give her 99% of the credit.
Great.
So I'm not sure what it's, it probably will be launched later this year, maybe the fall. And hopefully, I mean, we're doing it so as a public service, let's put it that way. So hopefully people will watch it and learn something from it.
Well, keep us posted so I can help promote it on social when it launches. I have one more question for you. What is one word that describes a mentally healthy life?
Balance.
There you go. The Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show. You guys are in the right place, listening to the right guest. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Paul Keck. How can people find you online and stay in touch with you?
Instagram account. Instagram is Paul Keck 31. Somebody hacked my account last week. So if you see Paul Keck 90, it's not me.
Oh, wow. Sorry to hear that. That happens to the best of us. My TikTok account got abducted and I can't get it back. Like, there's nothing I can do. But yeah, people are just crazy out there. So anyway, you are an amazing guest. Send my love to your wife. Tell her I want to get her on the show next. And everybody, thank you for listening to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show, where you can achieve happiness and success through alignment, not the hustle and grind. And until we meet again, keep your vibe high and magnetized. Bye, everyone. So excited to share a review from Melissa Myers, the Glow Girl. She says, inspiring podcast. Rebecca has a gift for creating meaningful, empowering conversations that leave you feeling inspired and uplifted. Balanced, Beautiful, Abundant is like sitting down with a wise, soulful friend who truly wants you to thrive in every area of your life. I love how she blends practical advice with spiritual insights. I'm so grateful I found it. Well, Melissa, we're so grateful that you found us, and we can't wait to find out how you are glowing and growing by using this podcast as a tool. And everybody who's listening and sharing, thank you so much for your support. And it's such a joy to be on this journey with you.